from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson.
Willie Mays up here drew a walk his first time. Runners at first and third with now one man out. A long, high drive hit to left field. That one's going way back. Snyder back near the wall. Tell it goodbye.
That's Hall of Fame broadcaster Lon Simmons describing a Willie Mays home run during the dramatic 1962 Giant-Dodgers playoff. Mays is not only the greatest Giant of all time, many would say he's the greatest ball player of all time. And now his life has been chronicled in a new biography called Willie Mays, The Life, The Legend. It's a book about baseball, of course, but also this unique American figure whose life straddled the cross currents of race and changing times. We'll talk with biographer James Hirsch after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. On October 3rd, 1951, a 20-year-old rookie stood in the on-deck circle hoping against hope he wouldn't have to hit in a playoff game against the Dodgers. A moment later, the rookie's worries disappeared as Bobby Thompson launched the most famous home run in New York Giants history. The shot heard round the world, sending the Giants to the World Series and the hated Brooklyn Dodgers to defeat. That rookie in the on-deck circle was Willie Mays. And 11 years later, to the day, October 3rd, 1962, Mays was once again in the on-deck circle. Once again, a trip to the World Series was online. But this time, Willie Mays was eager to hit, and he did, helping the now San Francisco Giants beat the Dodgers and sending the Giants to the World Series again. James Hirsch's fine new biography of Willie Mays tells that story, but it's a book that goes well beyond the baseball field. It also details Mays' life, his ups and downs away from the diamond, from money to marriage, as well as the role he played, or some say didn't play, in the country's battle over civil rights. The book is called Willie Mays, The Life, The Legend, and author James Hirsch joins us now. Good morning.
Thank you for inviting me, Dave. It's good to be here.
Pleasure to have you with us today. I want to ask you first about the cover. The cover of the book is a fabulous shot of Willie Mays. And he's wearing, I'm holding it here, a New York Giants baseball cap. How come?
Well, you know, obviously Willie straddled two cities in his career, New York and San Francisco. And we had to choose one or the other. There is, however, talk about putting him in a San Francisco Giant cap for the paperback. We kind of knew that we were going to disappoint, you know, half of Willie's fans, but there was no reason other than that.
But he is, in many ways, and we'll get to this, I know, later in the conversation, in many ways, even though he played more than half of his baseball career in San Francisco, there was always that tie to where his career began in 51 in New York.
Oh, absolutely. You know, Willie was the king of New York in those years from 1951 to 1957 when he was playing with the Giants. It was just a confluence of so many wonderful things in baseball and in America. You had the three baseball teams there, the Giants, the Dodgers, and the Yankees with the three great center fielders, Mays, Snyder, and Mickey Mantle. And you also had just this whole rise of a mass media culture. Television was just coming onto the scene and making its presence felt. Sports magazines were now being published, Sports Illustrated, Sport, as well as, you know, Life and Look, etc., all of which were desperate to find heroes to promote and publicize, including athletes, and Willie Mays fit the bill.
One of the things that's intriguing, of the many things that are intriguing about reading your book, is this sense of time. You observe early on that in many ways Willie Mays came along at just the right time. There are other ways in which the times were difficult for him, and we'll get to that too, about civil rights in particular. But if he'd been born 10 years sooner, his career would have been spent most likely in the Negro Leagues, and
right,
we never would have known the Willie Mays that we were so privileged to know in the 60s.
Willie was very fortunate with his timing. He was 20 years old when he joined the New York Giants, and so had he been born 10 years earlier, those first 10 years of his professional baseball career would have been spent in the Negro Leagues, and he may not have even gotten to the major leagues. This happened to other great Negro League stars who were ignored when they were, you know, just past their prime. And so, you know, Willie was really the first black player whose entire career major league fans could see. And in that sense, yes, he was fortunate as well, by the way, that he did begin his career in the Negro Leagues. He played for the Birmingham Black Barons for 3 years, where he learned a great deal about baseball and about life.
And that, and a style of play that also stayed with him.
A style of play that really emphasized that baseball is not just a game to play to win, but it's to entertain. You know, Willie was the consummate showman, and he really learned about that playing for the Birmingham Black Barons, because the Negro Leagues were there not just for sport, but for entertainment. They were woven into the fabric of the Negro community. The ministers on Sunday morning, at the end of their sermons, would say, now it's time to go to the ball field and watch the game. And it wasn't just baseball. It was the picnics and the beauty pageants and the jugglers. They were all out there for the festivity. And Willie learned that we're here not just to win, but to give the fans something to talk about as they leave the ballpark.
And it's also true that in that time, the Negro Leagues at least represented opportunity in baseball in a way that other sports did not. It's so interesting now because we have sort of the reverse situation where so many black kids don't play baseball, but participate much more actively in football and basketball. In Willie Mays' day, it was actually the reverse. You write that he was actually a really good football player and basketball player, but baseball was where opportunity was because of the Negro Leagues.
You know, Dave, I interviewed some of Willie's boyhood friends, and I was able to confirm this in the archives. Willie could throw a football 70 yards on the line. He was a phenomenal quarterback. And Willie himself says that baseball was probably his third best sport.
Wow.
But there were more economic opportunities in baseball. Even after the professional football leagues were integrated, they did not allow blacks to be quarterbacks, so Willie couldn't play his position. Basketball was problematic because then he'd have to go to college for 4 years, delaying when he could start getting paid. Sports was Willie's ticket out of Alabama, a way to support himself and his family, and baseball gave him the best opportunity.
And yet he was also very much always, it seems, from reading your book, a person of Alabama in so many ways. Describe something about what his childhood was like and the way in which living in Alabama in that time, growing up in the 30s and 40s, shaped who he always was.
I would say there are two important themes. One, that Willie's father, Cat Mays, who also played baseball as well as has had other jobs, really taught him about living the right way. Specifically, you do not smoke. You do not drink, you get your rest, you take care of your body. And he would tell this to Willie's friends as well. He didn't invoke any sort of moral reasons for doing this. He said that this is what you do because this is how you are able to make sure that you can play sports for as long as possible. You do it almost as an economic investment, if you will, because everyone knew Willie was going to be an athlete. So they put Willie on the right track in terms of taking care of his body. And Willie's greatest point of accomplishment for himself is that he played for so long so well, 22 years, and because he took care of himself. But the second important influence in Willie's youth, I believe, is that he was taught that if you want to survive in the white world, you have to keep your head down and your mouth shut. You have to avoid controversy at all costs. And there was a good reason for this. If you were black in Alabama in the 1930s and 40s, because those blacks who got out of line could be arrested, incarcerated, put in prison camps, have their homes dynamited, or lynched. And so Willie says that he was programmed to be a certain way, which was to always keep in the background, do not get out, do not say anything that could cause controversy. And of course, later this ultimately did create controversy because of his unwillingness to talk about civil rights. But Willie could never re-engineer the way he was brought up.
James Hirsch, our guest. He's the author of a new biography, great biography, called Willie Mays, The Life, The Legend. He'll also, by the way, James will be at Borders Bookstore, I should mention, at 5:30, across from the ballpark, across from AT&T Park this evening. Will Willie Mays be there? Do you know?
Willie will not be at the book signing.
Okay. But you will be at Borders, 5:30, across from the ballpark this evening. That part of who Willie was, the person who resisted controversy, really in almost every way possible, That stayed with him throughout his career. If there was a controversy, he wanted to look the other way, including when he first came to San Francisco. And there was all this controversy about him trying, he and his wife, Marguerite, trying to buy a house. And there was finally a big story that broke about that in the San Francisco Chronicle about the prejudice involved in the lack of that sale. He really didn't want to have that take place.
Right. Willie was always, and is to this day, ambivalent about his own celebrity. Willie loved the spotlight of center field, but he didn't like the public scrutiny that comes with fame. Moreover, he believes that his celebrity is perishable. To this day, despite all the goodwill he's created, he believes that if he says the wrong thing that perhaps prompts a controversial headline, people will turn on him. Willie is also very mindful of his education. He never went to college. Years ago, less so today, but certainly when he was a player, he was self-conscious of the way he spoke, his diction, his grammar, his high-pitched voice. Now, he worked on it, and he practiced, and he became ultimately a good public speaker. But for all these reasons, the fear that he was going to lose the goodwill that he had created, his own insecurities, he always wanted to avoid controversy and avoid the spotlight for anything that has to do with something potentially divisive. And ironically, avoiding the spotlight for all the good things that Willie Mays has done, a part of Willie's life that really no one knows about. Out of the media spotlight, what he's done for children, for friends, for people in need. You know, Willie, as you know, Dave, you know, has a reputation of being not just distant, but he can be brusque and even petulant. And there's some truth to that. But there's another side to Willie Mays of great warmth and generosity that, you know, fortunately I was able to find out about.
How did you persuade him to do that? Because that is the reputation, that he's distant, not particularly trustful of reporters. And it's noted on the cover that this is an authorized biography, which is a phrase I'd like you to explain as well in terms of what that means. But what did it take to persuade him? Well, was it in part having that he would have the kind of review power over the book?
No. It took me 7 years just to meet Willie. I was working with a friend of his trying to get an audience with him. But finally, in January of 2007, Willie agreed to speak with me. And I met him at his home here in the Bay Area. And Willie doesn't trust anyone, and particularly outsiders, particularly anyone who comes with a possible business proposition. But what I was able to say to Willie and ultimately persuade him was that now is the time to work on a book that tries to define your legacy on and off the field. And it's a book where you will not have editorial control, but your point of view will always be front and center. And specifically, the agreement was that Willie would read the manuscript before it was published, and he could correct any factual errors, but he couldn't impose any sort of editorial control on what I wrote, which is exactly how it worked. And in fact, Willie didn't ask for any changes. But I think what persuaded Willie was that, you know, I and a couple of others made the point that if you don't cooperate on a book like this now, someone else will do it years from now, when you won't be around to have your point of view known. Willie is very mindful of his role in American sports culture and in American history. And what I didn't know at the time, but learned soon after, he's extremely proud of the life that he's led. He's very mindful of the trajectory of that life. Born a Depression-era black kid in the Deep South, where blacks were denied their most basic civil rights, to reaching the pinnacle of the American sports world at age 23, to becoming an American icon who can fly on Air Force One with the president. As Willie said to me, I could not have dreamt the life that I've led. And ultimately, I think he wanted a complete outsider like myself to come in and validate that life.
James Hirsch, our guest. The book is Willie Mays, The Life, The Legend. Let's talk a little bit about the kind of ball player he was. He was the first, you say, of the so-called five-tool ball player, meaning that he could hit for power, he could throw, he could field, he could run. And one thing that I didn't realize until reading your book is that of all of the skills that he had, it was actually his arm that in some ways was the most noteworthy.
Joe DiMaggio said that Willie had the best arm that he had ever seen. Really, his first great play he made as a rookie, where he caught a line drive in right center field in the Polo Grounds. He spun around 360 and threw a Dodger player out at the plate. It was just called the throw. But in terms of Willie as a baseball player, really, he redefined the game of baseball. When Willie came in 1951, there were two prototypes for ball players. You had the classic home run hitter, the epitome of which was Babe Ruth, and then you had the high-speed, stolen base, high-average guy. The prototype of that was Ty Cobb. Yeah. We still had complete players like DiMaggio, Musial, Williams, but they were not known for their base stealing, and they weren't known necessarily for their defense. Willie Mays comes along, and he can lead the league in home runs and lead the league in stolen bases. That was unheard of, as well as lead the league in batting average and play center field, unlike anyone before or since, with a kind of style and panache that just left people shaking their heads. And so he was dubbed the five-tool player by Leo DeRocher, the first time that phrase apparently had ever been used, and he becomes the standard by which all other players are followed. You know, how many tools does he have? And there were other five-tool players who did follow, but I mean, looking at baseball today, how many can you say, you know, really fit that mold?
Is he the greatest ball player of all time?
I argue that he is the greatest because he could beat you in more ways than any other player. He could do more things than anyone else. What stands against Willie in that argument is that, you know, we judge players by their numbers and their statistics, and so much of what Willie did could not be captured by those numbers. Willie was always better than the box score. You know, scoring from first base on a hit and run single, slowing down on a play at the plate. So he times his arrival at the plate with the ball so he can run the catcher over, the ball rolls away so the trailing runner can advance a base. You know, those were the kinds of plays that Willie made that helped win games but were not captured in the box score.
You're right, in fact, that he doesn't hold any major record, and yet he's the greatest because of these things that are not quantifiable, which is interesting in a way, because baseball is the ultimate quantifiable sport.
Yeah, and there's something else about that, which is when you talk about the intangibles, it wasn't just that, you know, Willie could beat you in so many ways, but fans loved him, you know, and it wasn't just fans in America, overseas. You know, Willie would play in the Caribbean League, in Puerto Rico, in Venezuela, Mexico, Nicaragua, exhibitions in Japan. No matter where he went, he was mobbed by the throngs. And Willie, and he was loved, of course, by other stadiums, opposing teams, fans. They just, because he played the game with so much joy and so much exuberance, always 100%, that you know, that too counts for something.
It's a wonderful line that Pete Hamill wrote in the review of your book, that what you just said reminds you of. The last sentence of his review was, "The story of Willie Mays reminds us of a time when the only performance-enhancing drug was joy."
That was Willie, yes.
That joy and that style, though, in some ways you also write, disguise the fact that he was a really smart ball player and that he put a lot of mental energy into the game. He studied pitchers. He went over the field. He looked at how teams warmed up so he'd know who would have a good arm. There was a lot to his game, right, beyond the sort of stylish Mays that we think of.
Right. You know, I interviewed Tom Seaver when Willie was traded to the Mets in 1972. The first time that Willie played center field and Seaver was pitching, Willie comes up to Seaver before the game, and he's holding the opposing team's lineup. He says, "Tom, how are you going to pitch each of these hitters, and where should I play them?" And Seaver goes down the lineup and tells him. And then he and Willie arrange so that Seaver will reposition Willie as the game advances, based upon how he's throwing and how they're hitting. Seaver plays 20 years in the major leagues, the only player to ever approach him before a game and ask, how are you going to pitch these guys, and where should I play them, was Willie Mays.
Did he want to be a manager?
No. He did not want to be a manager because he would have never wanted that kind of responsibility, telling other people what to do. You know, Willie was never, even though he was the first black captain in the history of the major leagues, he led by example. He was not one who really relished the idea of disciplining other players or dressing them down. He would help them, but all the things that a manager has to do, you know, dealing with the media, that did not appeal to him.
I want to ask you a little bit more about race in Willie's life. You described earlier about the way in which the attitudes of the Deep South in the 30s and 40s shaped perpetually his view of race. Describe the conflict then that did occur during his career, particularly between Willie Mays and Jackie Robinson?
Well, Jackie was very critical of Willie because of Willie's unwillingness to speak out on civil rights. You know, Jackie, as you know, was very outspoken and became increasingly angry and bitter at the slow pace of integration in Major League Baseball and across America. And so in the 1960s, Jackie started publicly speaking against Willie and criticizing him. The truth is, you know, Jackie thought that Willie was an Uncle Tom. And those observations and that criticism hurt Willie. Willie idolized Jackie Robinson because Willie knew full well what Jackie did for all black players. And so that criticism stung him. Jackie didn't really understand, however, that first where Willie came from in the Deep South as opposed to where he came from California. Jackie went to UCLA, went to college, you know, two different, completely different orientations. And he didn't, and Jackie didn't understand that Willie could still make a contribution because really the civil rights movement needed this continuum of voices. Mm. You needed the militants to push the envelope and get America to move faster. But you also needed blacks who would preach conciliation. How can you get together? How do you diffuse fears that so many whites felt? And so really, I mean, both of them played a vital role in the movement. Unfortunately, Jackie could never really understand and appreciate what Willie did.
You have a really telling and eloquent quote from Willie Mays about this in your book that I'd like to read. He says to you at one point, "I can't, for instance, go out and picket. I can't stand on a soapbox and preach. That simply isn't my nature. Everyone must do his job in his own way. And in my heart, my way is just as important as Jackie Robinson's way. I believe understanding is the important thing. In my talks to kids, I've tried my best to get that message across. It makes no difference whether you're black or white because we are all God's children fighting for the same cause."
You know, I was often struck by how eloquent Willie was talking about issues like that. That was a quote from a press conference he held in 1968 after mm-hmm. Jackie Robinson had once again criticized Willie for being a do-nothing Negro. And Willie would talk about how, for example, in San Francisco, when he was initially denied buying a house in the St. Francis Wood area, but Willie stayed with it, and he and his wife did purchase that house there. He helped for other blacks who wanted to come in that neighborhood. Or when Willie was the first black to go into a country club, for example, he paved the way for other blacks. So in his quiet way, you know, Willie, I think, takes great pride in those contributions.
James Hirsch, our guest again, the book Willie Mays, The Life, The Legend. At 5:30 tonight, he'll be at the Borders across the street from AT&T Ballpark as the Giants take on the Rockies. If you're interested in meeting James Hirsch and getting a copy of Willie Mays, The Life, The Legend. We have to take a break in just a moment, but as a way of getting to the other side, in which Lon Simmons, the great Giants broadcaster, Hall of Fame broadcaster, will join us for a few moments. Just sketch out very briefly, if you would, James, the what it was like for Willie Mays to come here from New York and to leave that city behind.
Well, it was a jarring transition for Willie because he was so idolized in New York, and he was just very comfortable there, and not just at the ballpark and the Polo Grounds, but throughout the community. Suddenly, the Giants, as of course all the Dodgers, come west. The Giants come to San Francisco, and the city really did not embrace him initially.
And we'll talk about what happened when he came to San Francisco and his career here when we return. Lon Simmons will join us as well for a few moments after the break. If you have a question about the life and times of Willie Mays, go ahead and call us, too. We'll open up our conversation in our second half hour. Here's the number. It's 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786. Back with more in just a moment with James Hirsch, the author of Willie Mays, The Life, The Legend, and Lon Simmons in just a moment. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our guest this hour, James Hirsch. His biography is called Willie Mays, The Life, The Legend. And we're joined as well for a few moments from Hawaii, from the legendary Hall of Fame broadcaster of the Giants, Lon Simmons. Lon, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. Let's listen to a little bit of one of your calls. This is at the very end of the playoff series against the Dodgers in 1962. This was the three-game playoff after the Dodgers and Giants tied at the end of the season in 1962. So let's go back to October 3rd, 1962, and hear Lon describe the last out of that game.
So with the count 1-1 on Lee Walls, Lee backs away, doesn't want Pierce to quick pitch him, and Pierce backs off the rubber now. Two down, bases empty, Giants 6, Dodgers 4, bottom of the ninth. Pierce winds, here's the pitch. A line drive to center, this could be it. Mays waiting, he's got it, the Giants win the pennant. The Giants have won it as Mays, Pierce is mobbed by the Giants. They've won it 6-4 on a dramatic four-run rally.
Lon Simmons describing one of the greatest, probably the greatest moment of San Francisco Giant history. So fitting in some ways that Willie Mays made that catch. That audio is courtesy of the Bay Area Radio Museum. Lon, describe what that moment was like and whether or not that was also a moment when Willie Mays, having now played in San Francisco for five seasons, really was first finally embraced by the city of San Francisco.
Well, he was – the thing was that San Francisco was a town that that didn't accept outsiders too well as far as coming from New York. Willie had a New York tag on him, and they tended to go for the rookies who came in and were San Francisco Giants to start off with. But Willie did with the Giant fans what he did with fans all over the country. He won them over. In his minor league career, he was abused by comments from the stands, but he didn't pay any attention to it. He just went ahead in his first year, and he was batting 400, and they loved Willie Mays. That's the way Willie was. He didn't demand attention. He attracted attention by the fact that he did so many remarkable things, and you wound up loving him.
You know, in reading James Hirsch's biography, Willie Mays, The Life, The Legend, one of the things that I learned that I don't remember as a kid during that time, that Willie Mays was actually booed in San Francisco. Lon Simmons, did you ever talk with Willie Mays about that and what that experience was like for him?
Well, the only time that I really remember him being booed was when he it was a 3-0 pitch, and he swung. They were trying to intentionally walk him, and Willie swung at it, and he popped it up, and the fans booed. But Bill Rigney, who was managing the ball club, said, "I thought it was a great play because you can't tell Willie might have hit a home run off it." But I don't think that in my mind, that's the only time that I really remember anybody booing him, because he never did anything that you could. That you could boo him for. You went to the ballpark to see Willie Mays, and if he went 0-4, he made some spectacular catch or a great throw or something, and you came back saying, "My God, that Willie Mays, he's great." So here's a man who could have made it probably in any field that he wanted to. The thing was that he grew up with a tremendous athletic body and a tremendous abilities in baseball. And so that's what steered him, and he became one of the top player probably of his era in the game. So this is Willie Mays. He has many more facets than just being a center fielder and a great player. He can handle a lot of things, and Willie is happy with Willie. He doesn't have to. He's never had to wish that he was somebody else. He was realized how good he was. He realized what he could do. And as I say, I think he could have gone into any field and been successful.
Lon Simmons, the great Hall of Fame broadcaster for the Giants. James Hirsch, you mentioned at one point in your book, I think, that many of Willie's greatest characteristics, greatest virtues, actually weren't on display on the field, that there is a whole other part of his life and his contribution that go beyond baseball.
Absolutely. Willie is extraordinarily generous with friends and specifically with children. There's one of the themes really in the book is this tremendous rapport that Willie has long had with kids. In some ways, it was immortalized by the film footage of Willie playing stickball in Harlem with the kids, you know, when he was early in his career with the Giants. And Willie talks about how, well, he loves kids because he knows they won't betray him. As Lon knows, you know, Willie doesn't trust anyone. Namely, he doesn't trust adults. He's been taken advantage of many times over the years, exploited, and that has built up this sort of this wall of distrust among towards most people. But with kids and with his friends, he'll do anything that you ask him.
James Hirsch joining us this hour. His book again, Willie Mays, The Life, The Legend. Lon Simmons, the giant broadcaster, joining us as well. If you have a question for either Lon or for James Hirsch about Willie Mays, or an observation, your favorite moment of watching Willie Mays play, or a favorite moment when you've seen Willie Mays contribute in other ways, we'd welcome your thoughts and contributions to our program. Here are the numbers. You can join us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, or email us at forum@kqed.org. Here's an email from Michael, which speaks to really both of what you were just saying. Spring training in my hometown of Tucson, Arizona, in the early 1960s. Willie Mays and the Giants were in town to play the Cleveland Indians, and my dad asked Willie to pose for a photo with my 10-year-old brother and me. He was agreeable, putting an arm around each of us. We stood on either side of him. Later, he visited my dad's shoe store after my dad sent him and the other Giants pairs of shoelaces. His very presence, from my perspective, made statements that others think that he should have been making overtly on behalf of his race. So another way, James Hirsch, of the way in which he made contributions, not in the way that Jackie Robinson did, right, perhaps, but that very statement, the way in which he visited the shoe store,
right,
made its own statement.
You know, Dave, for the book, I interviewed Bill Clinton, in part because Clinton is friends with Willie, but I wanted to talk to Clinton about what it was like growing up in the Deep South, in Arkansas, in the 1950s, and Willie Mays. And Clinton said, you know, he was surrounded by segregationists who would fight tooth and nail to preserve Jim Crow during the week. But then on Saturday afternoons, they would stay home and watch Willie Mays play baseball and cheer for him. And, you know, even on a subconscious level, Willie changed the way white people viewed black people.
And how did that work, Lon Simmons, in terms of the way in the clubhouse, the way in which the Giants were a team early on that not only had a number of black ballplayers in 1951, Leo DeRocher started three, first time that ever happened, three African-American ballplayers, also a team that had a lot of Latino ballplayers for the first time in the 50s and 60s. Describe some about the way in which Mays played a role, perhaps, in having a clubhouse that was that diverse, that early in time function.
Well, Willie didn't make an obvious or intended effort to do any of that. That wasn't Willie's temperament. Jackie Robinson was different. Jackie criticized Willie for not coming out more boldly in favor of equal rights and so, but Willie did it by example, and not his temperament and his attitude wasn't to go out and make a big fuss. Hey, one of his stories that I loved was in the minor leagues when he was being yelled at in the South and the minor leagues and everything. And he said he didn't pay any attention to it. He just went ahead and he was hitting .405 in a couple of weeks. And now it was all, hey, Willie, we love you, you know. So this is how Willie did it. And this is his way. I mean, this is how he does things. And Jim making the comment about his way with kids. He was incredible how he could handle young people and talk to them and make them feel comfortable and make them be happy and make them enjoy things. He's a remarkable guy. He has the faults the same as a lot of other people do, but those faults are things that are generated by things that have happened to him in his life, and he isn't always comfortable or is not always certain that somebody isn't going to betray him, as Jim said.
Lon Simmons, the great Giant broadcaster, Hall of Fame broadcaster, joining us from Hawaii this morning. Lon, thanks very much for taking out some time of your morning today to spend it with us and talking about the great Willie Mays. Thanks for being with us.
All right. I'm a lot happier talking to you than I'm going to be in about a half an hour when I'm on the golf course.
Although Mays was also a great golfer,
yes,
right?
He was outstanding. He was an outstanding golfer, an outstanding friend, an outstanding player. I love him.
And channel a little Willie Mays when you're out on the tee, Lon. Thanks for being with us this morning. You know, and he continues to visit kids to this day. You tell a story about how he visits kids at the Lucille Packard Children's Hospital down at Stanford University. Those kids don't know even who he is, but he's right there.
Yeah, well, Willie was initially a patient there some years ago, and when he was admitted, he came in with a suitcase of baseballs because he would give the balls out to not just the surgeons and doctors, but the custodians and the nurses and everyone. You know, that's his way of conveying thanks. And then he goes back each Christmas to see the children. He wants to see the sickest children. These are, you know, 2-3 year old kids. He sits with them, signs a ball, and gives them the ball.
Let's go to our calls. I've been neglecting them because I want to ask all the questions, but we'll get some callers involved in our program. Neil's in San Francisco. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, hi. The first time I saw Willie Mays play, I was a young kid in St. Louis, and we were at Sportsman's Park. We were there to watch Stan Musial, and the Giants were playing the Cardinals, and Willie Mays made a single, and he pulled up lame. The trainer had to come out and work on him. And then the first pitch, he steals second base, and I was stunned as a little kid. I said, Dad, you know, how can he be hurt and then steal second base? And my dad looked at me and he said, because that's Willie Mays, son, and that's how he plays baseball.
Great
and
story.
I was always impressed by that.
Great story, Neil.
Thanks a lot.
And, you know, Willie would do things on the field just to keep things interesting for himself. Now, I don't know if he was actually hurt that time or just using it to decoy the Cardinals, but he was the kind of player who would do things on the field that you would always remember.
You know, there was a play in a Giants game a couple nights ago that made me think of your descriptions of that in the book, and it must have been a play that would have appealed to Willie Mays. Ryan Howard hit a line drive out to right field and thought he had an easy double, and what happened was that Nate Cheerholz, the Giants right fielder, rifled his throw back to second base, and Edgar Renteria, the shortstop who was covering second, acted like, there's no play, and you see Howard just kind of pull up, jogging in, and boom, slap a tag on him, and he's out. That kind of play is the kind of thing I suspect that Willie Mays would have loved seeing.
Absolutely. And you know what? I think I mentioned earlier that one of Willie's favorite plays was scoring from first base on a hit-and-run single. Doing research for the book really changed the way I look at baseball. I live in the Boston area. We were out last year in Fenway Park. Red Sox had a man on first base. They put on the hit and run. Batter shoots a single to right field. The runner speeds around second, goes to third. Outfielder gets the ball and just lobs it back into the infield. This indifferent rainbow in the general direction of second base. The runner never looks over his shoulder, but just by rote stops in third base. The fans all cheer, and I'm just thinking, if that had been Willie, he would have scored standing up. But because Major League Baseball doesn't have anyone who plays the game at Willie's level, fans don't even know how well it can be played.
Brian in Redwood City is next with a memory from Candlestick. Brian, go ahead.
Hi, I was just thinking of, first of all, Willie is the hero of my childhood. I admire him immensely, and I remember my brothers and I were all there, and we had talked about the things that Willie does on the field and the little things, and we were remembering that when he would run to center field in the first inning only, he would only always step on first base. So we all stood up. The Giants took the field. We were all staring at Willie. He stepped on first base, kept going to center field, and my brother Terry looked at us and said, you know, I'd pay money just to watch him do that. And that's how Willie was.
Great story, Brian. Thank you.
Thanks.
Describe how Candlestick affected, though, Willie Mays' career. A lot of people say, you know, if he'd played anywhere else, including the ballpark where the Giants play now, his career statistics would have been a lot different.
Right. Well, the main impact was that the winds went from left to right in Candlestick, and Willie had to adjust his swing. It was very difficult to hit a home run in left field to Candlestick, so Willie tried to hit the ball to the opposite field, and that surely cost him home runs in doing that. Willie also missed almost two full seasons in the Army in 52 and 53. You combine those two facts, the Army and the Candlestick, if he had played in ballparks like Henry Aaron, he could have easily had over 800 home runs.
You know, a little bit of interesting trivia about Hank Aaron that's in your book is that the Braves blew it. They could have signed Willie Mays and had an outfield of Willie Mays and Hank Aaron, and so did the Pirates. They could have had an outfield of Roberto Clemente and Willie Mays.
Willie was scouted by several major league teams, including both of those, and for the same reason, they neglected to sign Willie because signing black players at that point was still too controversial. Some teams wouldn't do it at all, and others that already had some black players were fearful that you could only have so many in your system at one time.
Elaine in Napa has our next call. Elaine, go ahead, please.
My dad grew. I'm 67, and my dad grew up in a very rough area of New York and was very afraid of blacks walking home from school, etc. He loved Willie Mays. He was a Giants fan forever, And then when Willie came out to San Francisco, we were here. And I was his only child, and I was, you know, the boy who knew all the statistics. And I tell you, it was because of Willie Mays that I had such a good feeling for black men who were strong and good. And I just think that that was the way he lived his life.
Elaine, thanks.
Fantastic.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for the call and for the observation. Let's get another story from Bill in Seattle. Bill, go ahead, please.
Oh, hi. Thanks. It was so great to hear Lon Simmons' voice. How many tight games I've heard Lon Simmons and Russ Hodges call. And I just wanted to ask the question. One of the most poignant stories in sports is Willie's end of his career, losing the ball in the sun in Shea Stadium and not getting around in the fastball and that rifle arm gone. How did he talk to you about that? How did he deal with that and think about that at the end of his career?
Right. Well, it was really obviously an unfortunate way for him to end. And, you know, Willie says, hey, you know, he gave it his best shot. And what I think Willie regrets about that, and certainly what I write about, is that those images of Willie misplaying those balls in the World Series in Oakland has made him, you know, this poster boy for the athlete who didn't know when to quit, or for that matter, the entertainer or the politician. And it's easy to forget that, you know, a lot of athletes play too long. Babe Ruth looked horrible at the end of his career. Aaron played too long. Mantle played too long. In other sports, Unitas, Ali, Gretzky, Jordan. It's very hard for these athletes to walk away from the glory. So Willie was no different than all those guys. But what we should remember about Willie was his longevity is part of the greatness of his legacy. At age 39, 40, Willie was still one of the best players, not just on the Giants, but in baseball. And so we should be celebrating and remembering what allowed Willie to play so well for so long, not the fact that he played 1 year too long.
Another observation about Willie Mays and race comes from Terry, who writes in, I couldn't help but laugh when your guest described Mr. Mays, because my own dad is so like that, somewhat aloof and untrusting. My dad is black and was raised in the Jim Crow South. Life for blacks was so tenuous that you could not afford to be open and trusting. And my father still isn't. When my siblings and I used to ask our mom why our dad was that way, she'd say, your dad came up real hard and saw things as a child that no child should see. I bet that was true of Willie Mays as well.
And, you know, one of my favorite anecdotes in the book relates to an observation by a sports writer, sports editor in San Francisco in the 1960s. He said he came to understand Willie's contributions to America when he was watching a Little League game down in Texas. And out in center field was the grandson of a Ku Klux Klansman, and the boys running around out there yelling, look at me, I'm Willie Mays. Hmm. And what's also true, Dave, is that Willie understands that contribution that he made to America. Speaking about the bigots, he said, I changed the hatred to laughter.
How do you put in perspective then, or how should we put into perspective the Mr. Leo, for example, that he always called his first manager, Leo DeRocher, Mr. Leo, that for some people was a sort of uncomfortable stereotype of the black guy and the white boss?
To this day, when he talks about Horace Stoneham, the owner of the Giants, he refers to him as Mr. Stoneham, or the owner of the Mets when he went there, you know, Mrs. Whitney. Willie was raised that way. You treat your elders with respect, and that's not a sign of being an Uncle Tom. That's a sign of being respectful, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
Bob in Berkeley has a thought about race as well. Bob, go ahead.
Thank you very much for taking my call. I grew up in San Leandro in the East Bay. In the era when Willie was playing, and he was actually my boyhood hero. I learned much later, I wasn't aware of it at the time, but San Leandro was viewed as probably one of the most racist areas in California. And the fact alone that he was my boyhood hero, I think, was kind of exceptional in itself. But it occurred to me later on, you know, my wife always comments that she doesn't understand how I grew up not being racist, given the environment in which I grew up. And I can't really necessarily account for all of that, but I think Willie Mays probably played a part. He was much more than just an exceptional athlete. He had a sense of class about him, just a way he carried himself and the way he comported himself that just was an example, and it told me that this was a black man who was just a man and a really wonderful, classy man. So I think it's very consistent with what you've been saying on the program. He led by example, and I think in that way, it's an example of how he did serve the civil rights movement in some way, or race relations in some way that would be impossible to capture, because that's something that's just between me and myself and my own experience. Mm-hmm. But I know that he was a model in certain ways that I think must have influenced a lot of people in the same way.
Bob, thanks. Well put.
And, you know, Jim Boughton, the New York Yankee pitcher who gained fame writing the book Ball 4, he grew up in northern New Jersey when Willie came into the major leagues. And he said to me that he grew up in a blue-collar town. He said, "We learned to love Willie Mays before anyone told us we couldn't."
866-733-6786 if you'd like to get in your favorite Willie Mays memory. There's still a few minutes to do so. 866-733-6786. Steve in Saratoga. Steve, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I had the pleasure of meeting Willie Mays when I was 8 years old, when my father took me to buy a baseball glove at a sporting goods store that Willie was there to help promote the opening. And it was just me and him in the store. And my dad handed the glove that he had picked out for me to Willie, and Willie put about three fingers into the glove and pounded the mitt and said, "That's going to be a fine glove, son, and I think you're really going to enjoy playing ball with this." And I kind of knew who Willie Mays was. I wasn't really starstruck, because when my dad asked me, "Do you want Willie to sign your mitt?" I looked up at him all confused and said, "Why would I want his name on my glove?"
Oh, Steve. Steve. Great story. Thank you.
He's a great guy. I just remember him being such a gentleman and such a, you know, just a real humble guy. And it was probably my closest encounter with a great, great athlete.
Steve, thanks. Thanks for the story. Rings true to you, I'm sure, of all the kid stories that you collected
and
over
what,
time.
And what the gentleman said about Willie being humble is so true. You know, Willie doesn't like talking about himself. He doesn't like to tout his accomplishments. If you ask Willie, "Who's the greatest player there ever was?" Willie would say, "Man, you can't ask me that. You can't ask me."
Yeah.
Someone else had to say, no, deep down, Willie thinks he is the greatest whoever played. But he will never talk about it himself.
A few more stories we'll try to get in. Lynn in San Francisco. Go ahead, Lynn.
Hi. My dad was the doctor to the Mays family, to Willie and his wife May and son Michael and Willie's dad. And in his gentlemanliness, he changed my dad's opinions about racism. And he's always been so gracious. And I do a lot of fundraising now, and I am allowed to go down to the house. He'll sign baseballs to help kids if you can auction off the items. He's just such a shining example and humble.
Lynn, I'm sorry we're going to have to let you go because your phone's breaking up, but thanks so much for sharing that story. Another example, James Hirsch, of the way in which he influenced and changed people, including the family doctor.
Those stories are plentiful. We could sit here all day and hear them. I'll just share one quick story about one thing that people ask me a lot about is, you know, Willie Mays' legacy. And I came to understand that when I went to visit my first grade son's class. I was invited just to talk about writing. At the end of the class, I said to the kids, "Who here has ever heard of Willie Mays?" These are 6 and 7 year olds. I was surprised by how many of the kids raised their hands. I said, "Well, how do you know who he is?" They said, "Oh, well, my father or my uncle or my grandfather told me about the great Willie Mays." They didn't know anything about him, but they just had this kind of platonic image of baseball greatness. And that's the legacy of Willie's Mays, you know, passing on to the next generation the magic and beauty of baseball.
Daniel in Tiburon. Daniel, go ahead.
My name is Daniel. My name is Daniel, and I wanted to relate a brief story to you about Willie Mays. Willie Mays was informed that my son, who was on a marked downhill course from leukemia, and he was age 13 years old. This was in 1982. And Willie agreed to come over to visit with my son, Lewis, and he did. He came to my house. He spent an hour with Lewis, talking to him. They spoke about baseball and other topics I can't recall now. He brought him a baseball bat, some baseballs, and some other gifts. It was one of the most wonderful experiences for my son, who only lived for another few months.
Hmm.
And I'll never forget the kindness of Willie.
Daniel, thank you. Thanks for telling us the story. You know, James Hirsch, it's interesting. We've had so many calls over the last 20, 25 minutes. They haven't been about baseball.
And that's fitting. I mean, one of the reasons I wanted to write this book was to make sure history knew the other side of Willie Mays, and all these calls just confirm that that objective was well sought.
One more from Edmundo in Oakland. Edmundo, go ahead.
Yes, well, I'm Chicano, grew up in East L.A. My dad was played ball when he was in Mexico. And what was striking to me is that growing up in L.A., when the Dodgers were such a powerful force there, it was Willie Mays that turned my dad and our whole family into Giants fans.
Way to go.
Right on.
Edmundo, thanks. That's a great baseball reference to help bring our program to a close. I want to ask you one last thing, James Hirsch, because we've talked a fair amount about race and the way in which that played out and the kind of influence that Willie Mays had in his own way on race. And at the end of your book, you write something about politics, and that is that while he'd never followed presidential politics, he really paid attention to the 2008 race. And he stayed up, you say, until 5 o'clock in the morning watching the returns. And when he woke up, he sent this email to President-elect Obama. "Dear Mr. President, move on in. Your friend, Willie Mays."
Yes, and that is great. Willie met Obama when Obama was still a U.S. senator before he even ran for office. And then one of Willie's last goals in his life was to fly on Air Force One. Obama invited him last year to join him when he went to the All-Star Game in St. Louis. And so Willie achieved that goal as well.
James Hirsch. Biography, Willie Mays, the life, the legend. He'll be at the Borders across from the ballpark tonight at 5:30. James Hirsch, thanks for being on our program this morning.
It's
really
been
my pleasure.
My pleasure.
Forum is produced by Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. Our engineer is Howard Gelman. Dan Zoll is our senior editor. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED. Go Giants.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.